Why do you say that, Father? You aren't afraid, are you?
No. But I respect some of the superstitions of others. Often they are founded in fact.
Broadcasting live from our Sanctum Sanctorum in Venice, California, this is the Sixth Sense Society. I'm your host, Krista, here with our producer, Michael, and today we welcome on the show Sean Sanford II, and he's going to be talking today about, with us, the importance of ritual. Sean is a Freemason. He's a member of this lodge, number 369, and he's also the co-host of the YouTube Masonic channel, Illuminations. So we're really happy to have him here, but before we get started, Michael has a few announcements.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. We're really glad to have you guys as always. We're getting close to the end of the year. We've only got a couple more episodes left, and then we're going to take a hiatus in December as always and come back with a bunch of great shows in January. And we are going to make one change starting in January. We're going to move from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. and it's going to help us a little bit with our setup and kind of if we have to troubleshoot not being quite so pressed and panicky for time. So keep an eye out for that, but that'll be in the new year. Next week, we have Lama Kathy Wesley coming back talking about the Buddhist Hell Realms, and that's going to be awesome and a great way to end the year with her. And you can get all the information on the shows that are coming up on our website, sixthsensesociety.com, S-I-X-T-H, all spelled out. And while you're there, buy us a coffee on Ko-Fi. It helps us to cover our costs. And please, a big thank you to all those who have. You know, you guys have been very generous, and it makes us feel very appreciated. So we very much appreciate it for sure. And the best thing you can do is tell your friends about us, click like and subscribe, and getting new subscribers is always exciting as well. So I don't want to take up too much more time because I know that there's a lot to talk about today, so I'm going to kick it back to you. So take it away, Krista.
Great. Thank you, Michael, and welcome, Sean.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me. How are you doing, Krista?
Doing pretty good. We're really happy you came in on such short notice, so we really appreciate that.
Well, I was chomping at the bit for the inquiry. I was like, hopefully they call me one day.
Well, we would have called you, definitely. It was just a little sooner than we thought. So we're really happy to have you here talking about this particular topic, which we haven't done before. We've definitely had people mentioning certain kinds of rituals, but we've never really tackled the idea of what is the importance of ritual, which I think is a really fabulous idea. So let's get started on that. I thought that it might be interesting to find out your own personal journey with rituals, maybe when you first noticed a ritual was positive. What kind of ritual was that?
I think from the very start, it kind of showed me a little more patience, because growing up, I wasn't really that patient. So coming in, they were like, yo, you got to be patient and you got to always stay, you know, in the right mindset, keep everything even keel. And, you know, when things go bad, you don't always have to act out of character.
Mm-hmm. And was this through masonry, or was it some other type of ritual that you first started learning about patience?
No, it happened with masonry. I didn't really know too much about patience. I just kept everything. For me, a maybe was a no. If I have to wait till tomorrow, that's a no. So when I came to the doors, they showed me a great deal of patience because I had to wait months.
That's a good point. Yeah, you don't get all the different degrees right away.
Right. And then even when I got in, it was like, oh, you still need patience to wait to the next step and then the next step, you know. There's a lot of other things that go with it.
So what drew you into Freemasonry?
I was always interested because I heard a lot of negative things. And then I'm the type of person that if I hear something negative, that means the people don't know about it. And, you know, they're speaking from the outside. So I was like, maybe I need to go see what it is from the core. And then I can have my own view if it's negative or not. Plus, I have family in it. So I figured it couldn't be too negative if I have family in it. You know what I mean? My grandfather was a Mason. His father was a Mason. So I figured, hey. It's in the family, so.
And where were they Masons?
My grandfather was a Mason out here in California. He was a Prince Hall Mason back in the 80s, 90s. I don't know which lodge. I tried to look it up, but it's so long ago, I can't really find it. But everyone else is pretty much in Alabama. My aunts are Eastern Stars and stuff. They're all in Alabama, though.
Oh, it's really interesting, you know, and I'm almost obviously a past master of the same lodge that Sean belongs to. So we're brothers, and it's exciting having him here in the lodge. We really enjoy hanging out. But ritual, of course, is a huge part of Freemasonry, as many such things are. But it really does change you. And I think ritual, there's something about it. And Sean sort of alludes to this too, that there's a groundedness that comes with it quite often. And you feel a little more connected, perhaps a little bit more secure, as he says, you know, in some ways. But I really do think that ritual has that ability to shift consciousness in a way. And we see it in not just masonry and spiritual things, but we were talking about this earlier, Krista and I, that in sports in particular, you know, Sean has a background in sports. You know, we think about just all the ritual that happens in sports as a way of kind of creating a mindset that you're ready to compete at the highest level. And so much of what goes into that is actually very ritualistic as well.
Right, because playing D-line in sports, we didn't need patience. We had to get there now.
See?
So I never really had patience because it was always get there now, now, now. Run on the field, run off the field, you know what I mean?
Right.
Run to the locker room, run off the locker room. It's always now, you know. So patience took a while for me to get, but I'm grateful for it. I'm still learning, though.
That's a very good point, though, how things can be positive and negative depending on the application of it. You know, that in your case, it was a positive as a football player.
Right. But maybe if I played a different position, I would have had, you know, a different take on patients because different positions have different, you know, rules and regulations, that, you know. But for my position, it was definitely no patience. So as a person, I developed a no patience mentality. And like you said, it could be good and it could be bad. It was good in one way, but bad in the other. But, you know, we live and learn.
Michael says in the Kabbalah, it's part of the warrior path, which would be certainly a football player, is the right-hand path, and it's not known for its patience.
Right, right, exactly.
Has other talents.
Because on the offense, they want to score now, so there's no patience. And then on the defense, we want to stop them. So it's like everything's high motor and high intensity. Mm. So patience is hard to come by as a young man sometimes when you're playing a sport like that.
That's a good point. It's a very good point. Now, Freemasonry, when we look at ritual can be quite formal and it can be quite informal, but Freemasonry has a more formal approach to ritual in that it has set practices that people memorize. They stick to, generally speaking, to their history. They'll change some of the ritual. And how do you feel about having something, that kind of a ritual in your life where you're sort of told a certain practice and you memorize it? And how does that affect you?
It's a bit intriguing to know that people that date back hundreds of years were practicing the same thing. And it goes to show why they were the type of person they were, you know, good or bad. Sometimes, you know, they could take the craft in a negative way. Like you say, some things can come in a good way or a bad way. But for me, it's like when you see people doing the same thing you're trying to accomplish, it's like, okay, I'm not alone in this, you know? So it's a good thing to have.
I was going to ask Krista a real quick question. I know that when we were doing, when I get involved in masonry, and I took a little hiatus there from it for a little bit, but she would say, I believe, and she can correct me, that when I was doing the ritual a lot with the masonry, that it did change my demeanor, I think, a little bit. But what was it that you noticed about that? And then tell people, too, about what happened with the dreams when we were doing the rituals, with your dreams.
Well, that's the main thing I remember is when Michael went through each of the degrees in masonry, I had really Masonic dreams. Like, they were, one was a Knights Templar dream, And I,
nice. You know,
yeah, I was connected to him, and it was really surprising. I wasn't really expecting to have that kind of experience. Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, I've noticed that, you know, when people get through the, especially maybe the first degree, you can see that people have already, the men that I've seen has seem to have gone through something, you know, like it seems like it already has had an effect on them. And,
yep.
And so that's the thing. I don't remember about the demeanor part, Michael, but the dreams I do remember, and I wrote them down there somewhere in my journal.
Yeah, it's really funny. With the first degrees, one of the things I've noticed about it is that there's a certain purification aspect to it. And quite often a person will get their first degree in Freemasonry and then everything kind of hits the fan, whatever stuff they haven't really been dealing with that they need to clean up. And it can be financial stuff, it can be relationship stuff or home stuff, but that there's quite often some kind of a purification almost that happens where it kind of forces them. And so it does seem very mystical and very magical in that way, that when you take that first degree in Masonry, that there's a lot of stuff that sometimes you have to end up dealing with and cleaning up in your life as a result.
Yep, for me it was everything. But it's interesting that you said that after he went through the first degree and second degree, you start having dreams. My uncle, he's not a Mason. He's actually a Muslim. But once I started going to lodges, he said he knew already that I started going before I actually told him. Oh. And I was like, how did you know? He was like, the way you just started to act, it was a whole different approach to you. He was like, I've watched you since you were a baby, so I know something was different. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. And he was, I believe, a Demolay as a child. So the way I would sit sometimes, he'd be like, I know that sit. You know what I mean? Like, I know that stance, you know? So I was like, it's good to see that it was rubbing off before I was even able to know what I was even doing, you know? Some people would tell me, like, you're already standing like a Mason. You don't even know it. And I was like, I don't know, you know? It's just a normal stance to me. But they were like, nope. You know?
That is so interesting.
But that also speaks to the idea that we were just talking about, that how a ritual itself impacts consciousness and it impacts your mindset in a certain way. And I think that there really is a power in ritual, whether, again, it's an elaborate mystical ritual, a spiritual ritual, ceremonial magic ritual, or whether it's just everyday superstitious rituals that we do, you know, that I tie my right shoe first before my left shoe all the time. And if I tie my left shoe first, then I suddenly don't feel like, you know, the world is quite right. And
if I do that, you have that.
Really?
Yes. It'll stay off for like 5 minutes before I put it on if I tie my left shoe first.
Huh.
And I don't know why. My body just won't even put the shoe on.
Now, was that from when you were playing football, do you think?
Mm-mm. It's just, I don't know when it started. I guess I usually just put the right shoe on first, like you say, you know, because I'm right-handed, but I don't know. If I put the left one on first, I always have a pause. I noticed that like last week too. It's funny that he brought it up now, because I noticed that. I'm like, why did I just take so long to put my other shoe on? I put everything else on and then I was like, okay, let's put this last shoe on. Like, it was ridiculous.
I remember Patrick Waugh, the famous NHL goaltender, and one of his rituals was to face the net when he first would start a game and visualize it shrinking behind him and getting smaller and smaller. And that was a part of his visualization ritual he did every game. And you know, the guy ended up in the Hall of Fame. So I don't think the net maybe physically changed shape, but, you know, who's to say it didn't have a big influence on the way he played?
Right. I will usually go to like the northeast corner without even knowing what that meant, to just do like a pregame ritual, just to, you know, and now that I was going to the first step, I was like, oh, northeast corner. I used to always go. I don't know. I just saw people doing that, you know, as a kid watching the NFL. And so I just figured I'd pick up little things. I probably was watching Freemason NFL players do things
You could have, for sure.
You know, one player, I noticed him doing some celebration. I was like, did he just do something I thought he did? But I don't know. I might have been wishful thinking. I don't know.
I want to go back to this idea that there is a collective connection through ritual, through, you know, the idea that your uncle was it, and then Michael and the dreams that I had, and then also the idea that when you talked about, you know, it's interesting that you're connecting in with people that used to do it. I think you can even connect into their consciousness through the ritual. Like, you might have this experience of that lineage coming. I've had that in Buddhism happen to me, where I felt the lineage through my practice, and it's such an amazing experience.
Yep. I think because going back to how my uncle was feeling, I think because I used to slouch a lot, you know, and then some certain things teach you, you know, to sit upright or stand upright and, you know, sit a certain way. And I was just like, yo, maybe it's, you know, like you say, it's rubbing off. Mm-hmm. But like you said, what did you say? Spiritual?
Well, that idea that lineage can kind of
Oh, yeah.
speak through you, the history of having done the ritual, that, you know, like, you know, maybe Washington did it. I was actually
about to say George Washington. Like, it's funny you say that. Sometimes when I'm reading it, I'm like, wow, George Washington was reading the same thing. You know what I mean? Benjamin Franklin was reading the same thing. It's surreal to me to know that other people as high as they were, were going through the same thing as I was. So, you know, shows that I got a little talent somewhere, I guess.
Well, maybe you were a Mason in a past life, too.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, maybe that is true.
Another thing that's really interesting about ritual is the ability to harmonize group energies with it. If you look at a large congregation in a church or even in a Masonic lodge and so forth, or in a Wiccan circle, you know, the idea that the ritual itself has a tendency then to sort of bring everybody to the same place at the same time, and that it's very powerful to be able to kind of focus that group energy and have it be so aligned, I think. And ritual is maybe the only way that you can achieve that in many respects.
Mm-hmm. It's the structure, you know, you just have a certain ritual to do things a certain way. That way you stay on the same schedule every day or every other day. Some people do, you know.
It's kind of like making some order in the chaotic world, too, is what ritual helps because of the structure idea.
Yep.
Yeah, I think ritual really brings a lot of order to your life when you think about it, you know. And as I said, even the superstitious rituals have that tendency to create a sense of order. And I think there's something important in that for sure.
Yeah, because like I was telling you earlier, some things that would make me act out in public, now I just be like, hey, whatever. You know, I've been taught a certain thing to, you know, never don't let everything bother you. Everything isn't your fight, you know, so.
Yeah, that's a good one for a warrior to know. To know when not to fight.
Right.
I remember one time I used to pick battles that were really ridiculous. And I read this. Pablo Coelho has a great book. I think it's called something about the spiritual warrior, and it's all these different quotes. Mm-hmm. So he says in the book that every warrior has a sword, and you need that, but you're not supposed to draw the sword out all the time.
Right.
But he says if you do draw the sword out, it's always for the kill.
Right.
Only draw it out for that reason.
Exactly.
And so I just read that. I was on the bus. And the bus driver was a woman. I pulled the stop, and she went past my stop. And so I got up to argue with her, right? And I was like, you just passed my stop. And I started arguing with her, and she started like getting grumpy back to me, which I don't blame her. And then all of a sudden I just stopped. I remembered that quote. And then I said out loud, I don't want to ruin your day. Don't worry about it. And she literally stopped the bus. And we had this moment, like I'll never forget it, of real connection. And it was like, wow. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe I even did that. And I just happened to say it out loud, too, instead of just to myself. And I said, wow, that really worked, because I thought of the sword. I'd drawn my sword over a stupid thing.
You were a warrior in your last life. You're just ready. You're ready for war all the time. Ready, like, you're just ready. You're like,
So, yeah, but getting back to the whole ritual idea. Now, when do you think... sometimes rituals need to be changed and structures don't work anymore. Have you ever had that experience of any kind of a ritual that you've done for a while, but it's just not working anymore? For whatever reason, it's not effective, or perhaps like, I know with the Scottish Rite, they had to rewrite some of the degrees because they were so long.
Yeah.
And so it was outdated in the sense that not many people really wanted to follow that.
Yeah, I hear they used to be very long. I joined this year, so I guess I got a little shortened version. But yeah, for a while, I hear they were pretty long, and that made people not want to join because they didn't want to sit through this long thing all day and night, you know. And I don't blame them, you know, being up there in age or having a family, or I'm not even up there in age, but not wanting to sit in one place at the whole time at 28, yeah. You know, I'm going to be like, good Lord, I got here at 6 a.m. Matter of fact, yeah, that happened. I got there at 6 a.m. and I didn't leave until 6 p.m. And I was like, good Lord.
That is long.
Lord, have mercy.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that there's like there's ritual. Also, you could sort of divide ritual into inner and outer, like the outer being the formal structure. Then there's the inner experiences of the rituals. And I suppose one would want them to support each other, the inner and the outer structures.
Yeah, like it was a time where a lady came. I was at work and I do security. So she comes and, of course, I'm the punching bag. So she comes and she's shouting, these people up here won't let me down. I'm sitting here like, and I just said, you know what, I'm going to just smile at her. Because whatever she's mad at, she got the right to be mad. I can't tell her she can't be mad, but I'm not gonna blow up over it, because whoever made her mad, I got to deal with it. So, hey, But when I smelled at her, she just said, can you just make sure they don't tow my car? I was like, see, I got you. Because you noticed that I might be directing this energy to the wrong person. Because I really didn't have nothing to do with that. I got there like 5 or 10 minutes ago. And she was just going. I was like, ooh, I don't even know what you're talking about. But hey, whatever it is, you're right.
There's another aspect to ritual, too, that it happens, not so much with the superstitious rituals, perhaps, but ritual as a part of being able to impart a teaching, which is part of what we see in the Masonic ritual, where it's a sort of a morality play that reinforces the basic tenets of our philosophy and how we should act and so forth as a moral person in our society. And so the ritual itself is, and it's interesting because it's one thing to maybe just, you know, say these things, but I think by having a physical play ritual, in some ways it makes that message that much deeper and stronger.
That's true. And particularly like when I was in the Eastern Star, and we don't have as long a degrees as Freemasonry, the Blue Lodge, but we have to memorize our degrees too. And the memorization process is very good because you just start like thinking about some of those thoughts naturally that are within the, you know, whatever the lecture you're learning. You start thinking, it goes into your subconscious mind because it's memorized. And I know memorization is good for many things, but it seems like rituals that include memorization can have an extra effect.
Because I've actually never been to, what do they call it? Do they call it lodge or chapter? What do they call their buildings or their meetings?
Chapter meeting.
Yeah. I've never been to one. I was always interested. How does that even go? Like, how many degrees do they do?
Well, the Eastern Star is all like one. You know, you go through the star point. So the star point is based on women figures from the Bible. And so you do there's just one degree, and you go around the star point. And then, you know, once you become a member, you can kind of go up the line, you know, to become the matron. And so you learn, you can take the part of one of the star points, and that's when you memorize the lecture. And they're actually really beautiful. And it's got the Eastern Star, to me, has a lot of esoteric meaning that I don't know that they know it. And right. Because I started doing some lectures on it, like the star point is connected to Venus, and it's sort of, you know, it's more of the feminine, some feminine aspects of Masonry. So in that way, it's really, really beautiful, but it's not as arduous in terms of the actual initiation and things like that.
Really? I have to go to one of those meetings.
You can join too.
I was going to say, yeah. I could actually join.
Yeah, huh?
Do I have to have a wife first? I don't know.
No,
I don't
know the rules. You can join. They would love they would love it. I was a member at the Ocean Park when it was early on, when it was still here. And then I went over to the Rob Morris chapter, which was really nice.
Where is that one at?
That's over in Santa Monica.
Oh, okay. It's, so they're all pretty much in the same area.
Yeah. The one Ocean Park's no longer here. They merged with another chapter.
I was going to say, did they meet here?
Yeah. They used to meet here.
You know,
yeah.
Certainty.
They used to meet here. And then the Rob Morris chapter meets, I think it still meets in the Santa Monica Lodge there.
Oh, so you don't go anymore?
No, I demitted mostly because I no longer really had time. And I'm one of these people, if I don't join a group, I don't stay. So I could rejoin because I demitted. And if I just felt I didn't have the time anymore. Right. And I was probably a member for about 10 years of the Eastern Star.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I enjoyed many aspects of it. I think there was a point where I felt I wanted the chapter to the Eastern Star to change. Like they have this weird rule that you have to have like a Masonic affiliation in your family.
Yeah.
And they need to change that. But some of the chapters aren't ready for that and others are.
I was going to say some changed that, but some were like, no.
Yeah,
no.
They're...
Actually...
makes it hard for them to grow.
I was going to say, I think a lot of the Prince Hall affiliate chapters stick to the core rule, the rule from the have an affiliation before you join type thing.
Oh, they have that there too?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was hard because I would have friends that, and they may very well have Masonry in their family, but not everybody could find out.
Right, yeah, because some people just won't tell you.
Yeah.
You know?
So I could have had at least a half a dozen people that wanted to join, and so it was very, you know, it was really kind of depressing to me that I couldn't have my friends come join with me.
Exactly, and it makes it the secretive part for the guys make it hard for people like me that'll wear like something like this because people will be like, aren't you supposed to hide that? And I'm like, no, It was like, yeah, but I thought there was a secret society. I was like, well, if it's a secret, then how do you think you know everything about it?
Exactly.
Like, people will try to tell you everything about what you do and then be like, but it's a secret society, right? And I'm like, if it's secrets, then how would you know it?
Yeah.
You just know what you think you know, and that's not true, obviously.
If I can ask a question to Krista real quick and to get us back on the topic of ritual maybe a little bit. I know you studied Buddhism for a long time, and Buddhism, at least from an outsider's point of view, seems to be very heavy in ritual. So can you share maybe some of your experiences in Buddhist ritual and what you found to be empowering or how it affected you in some way?
Yeah, I think I can't speak of all the different types of Buddhism, but Tibetan Buddhism is heavily into ritual. Mm. And surprisingly, I was drawn into it because I wasn't raised in any religion. And when I think about it, I really kind of like spontaneous things. But what I think I like about the ritual, first of all, like Freemasonry, there's a lot of symbolism in their ritual. And so you don't get bored. You can study the ritual for many, many years. Mm. The other thing I found, it's really nice doing the group practice together, because Buddhism can be very lonely feeling. Because you're sitting in silence, and and so some of the rituals, even sitting with people in silence, was different than sitting at home in silence. Right. And you actually really formed friendships that way. It was really amazing. So I found that the ritual for me engaged my mind a lot. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's a lot of visualization, which I never thought I was good at until I found out there's different ways to visualize. Like you can feel it, and that's legitimate. And I'd be always like, because in the pujas, which the pujas were these, sort of lengthy rituals where you visualize a particular deity and the deity's doing all kinds of things, and they have like Tibetan letters spinning around, and I mean, it's really crazy how complicated it is. And I used to get a little depressed, like, I'll never be able to do this. And it didn't, there's different, what I found with their rituals, there's different levels of experience within the rituals, and you shouldn't really worry about it. The idea is that you just do the best you can, and it has an effect on you. Like, I was thinking, like, okay, because I can't do it perfectly, this ritual, it's not going to have a great effect on me. And that's not true at all. Mm-hmm. Because when I left Buddhism for a while to explore other things, I eventually went back because the rituals really did impact my consciousness in a way that I hadn't really recognized until I was away from it long enough. So what I also like about the Tibetan Buddhist rituals is they really try to combine all of your senses. Mm. So you'll have mind, you'll see things, smell, touch, what else? Words, you're also saying things out loud. And so the idea is like you're working with all your senses. Again, it does have a kind of purification effect on it, I think, without you really realizing it. You're not really aware, because sometimes you're really bored crazy doing the same thing over and over, which is one of the challenges of rituals, the repetitiveness of it.
That will probably be the reason someone ease off doing that same thing, because it's like, oh, is this still working? Because every day isn't the same, obviously.
But yeah.
I think having something in the structure will keep you steadfast anyway, so any type of ritual will work. I haven't had a ritual. I need to work on one, but outside of football and now, obviously, from this year, I've been finding different things. And one thing I need to learn how to do is fall asleep at night, though. I need to make a ritual for that. Maybe I need
you
to
can actually,
start getting into bed or something.
You can make a ritual out of sleeping. So what you do is you try to go to bed at the same time. That's the first thing. You can tell yourself things during the day. Like, they do this for dream work. Like, during the day, I'm going to remember my dreams. But you can also do it for just, having a good night's sleep. Mm. You can also add things as a ritual to going to bed. So I put, like, sometimes lavender on my pillow because it helps me sleep.
I love lavender.
Yeah, that's what. Funny. Sometimes be careful not to put too much. I did that one time, and I was waking up because it was like, whoo.
Yeah, so much.
So much. I was like, I dumped it on the pillow. And so you can make it into, you can also put ritualistic things around your bed. Like in my case, I'll put like a dream catcher, because ritual can also involve implements, to remind us or to even use during a ritual. I mean, masonry has lots of things that are implements to show what officer it is and what it symbolizes. And it's true for Buddhism has a lot of it as well. But for going to sleep at night, you could turn it into something more ritualistic.
Hmm. I need to work on that then. Thank you.
And then, you know, let's talk a little bit about a daily practice too. So one of the things I found as a working person that when I was young and had lots of energy, I could do daily practices that demanded more attention. But as I, you know, now that I'm always really busy and I have a really kind of different schedule every day, I've resorted to a very brief daily practice. But because I do it every day, it actually helps. Like if I miss it, even though it's only like 10 minutes in the morning, I'll do something, definitely do something. Mm-hmm. And though I've added now Qigong, which I do for only 20 minutes. So it's only like a half an hour thing every day. But I have to admit, over like a couple of years, it's had a really big effect on me.
Hmm. Yeah, I had a thing I used to do daily, like a little small little workout. And it used to bring me a little peace. And I think I need to get back to doing that.
It also, one of the things about having a ritual that speaks to you on a day-to-day basis, it brings a kind of stability. You know, like for me, when the pandemic started and we were kept inside, now I've always liked to, you know, like Tai Chi, but I'd kind of gotten away from it like on a regular basis. And to be honest, I never practiced it every day, maybe three times a week. And then I found this free channel that had yoga and Qigong, and I knew a little Qigong, and and I just started doing it every single day because of my anxiety, and it really helped. It was like, I mean, I have to say I'd been doing mantras, but that Qigong, that simple, because it's so easy and it's so simple. Yoga too would be good.
I have a bad groin, so like you said, with the mind at ease, and then it's stretching as well. So it's like killing two birds with one stone. Well, not, I don't want to use that phrase.
I know.
With the great crow that we have.
I know. I can't use that anymore, too. I know. I can't even see birds being killed on television shows anymore.
Oh, my God. Like, I hate seeing roadkill. I'd be like, oh, my goodness, poor thing.
I know. But, yeah, having the, you know, rituals that, and I think, you know, it seems like the ritual has to connect to you on some level. Having said that, I have found sometimes that it's good to push ourselves to do rituals when we're not feeling like quite, you know, I don't feel like doing it, but you do it anyway.
That's my big problem with it. If I don't feel like doing something, I'm just not going to do it. And I'll be like, I need to do it. And then I'll just be like, so it's like two people in my head. Like, I don't care, dude. I'm not doing it. And I'm like, good Lord, we have a lot to read and so little time to do it. I don't care. We'll do it tomorrow. Tomorrow comes, we'll be like, yeah, okay. Tomorrow's like, come on, man.
You can always also have food rituals. Like, again, I was thinking during the pandemic, for some reason, I had this ritual of having ginger tea and an apple.
And I had a food ritual eating too much. I was 300 pounds.
Well, that's understandable. I think a lot of people had that.
Lord, and I hated it. I used
to keep in mind, too, that talking about food or rituals or that, in Asia, the tea ceremonies, which are incredibly elaborate rituals, that they do. And so, yeah, I think that can very much be a part of it.
So you can kind of play to your strengths. And so even if you're not like a religious person, you can find rituals that have a depth and complexity in it that give you the same results of like you learn patience. And I've also learned discipline. Having a ritual has taught me what discipline is. And also, like in Buddhism, they're really big on mantra counting. Mm. And there's different like kinds of counts. You can do like a 40-day count. You can do a 21-day count. You can do a million mantras.
I was going to say they say 21 days is how you create a habit. So
yeah, that's the shortest one.
And like Elza Mystic said, when you consider a daily practice, no matter how brief, over years, it does become you. If you do that same thing, even if it's only for 5 minutes, it just becomes you.
It does. Yeah. It's more integrated. That's a really good point. I'm glad you noticed that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the mantra thing is really interesting. And I was, as I was doing them, I suddenly decided I was going to start counting certain mantras. And I did this one. I decided to do a million mantras, which seems like a lot. And it is the way I did it. Most of them do it a lot faster. But then I realized most of what the mantra practice taught me was first of all, it built up my willpower. Mm. Like I had a goal and I made it, and I did it daily. And then, of course, it teaches discipline because I swear to God, sometimes saying 10 mantras it seemed like forever.
I was going to say, did you get to a million?
I had this like inner voice tell me to do it. So I said, well, okay, I'll do it. and it's my favorite Green Tara. So I really like her. And there's, believe me, there's people that have done way more mantras than I have in Buddhism.
Lord.
But I did feel really good. And also at the end of two of my major mantra commitments, I was gifted something by total stranger that was related to Tara. That was really unexpected. One was a book. And one was a beautiful painting of Tara.
Nice.
And when that happened, so to me, you know, it is interesting how certain times we do ritual, and I don't think it's the length of time, though in my case it was, I think, the depth of our experience, we draw in things that show us that the ritual has had an effect.
Yeah.
Without meaning to draw it in. Like, I didn't mean to have that happen.
Right. It just became like she said, it becomes you, and then somehow, some way, the world's energy just starts to gravitate towards it for you. And I think that's very interesting how our world works.
And the other thing that in making a daily practice, what I remember from my teacher, Kenpo Carter Rinpoche, he was no doubt a true Tibetan Buddhist master. And I was just really lucky to meet someone like that. And he said, I remember early on with meditation, it's always better to do something every day for a short period of time because it has a snowball effect. So rather than doing an hour two times a week of meditation, you do 10 minutes every day. It's more powerful.
Right.
And that's why with the mantra practice, I did decide to start little tiny, because I knew I could do that.
Right.
And even that was hard. Even like 10 minutes a day initially for me was like, oh my God.
Where do I find the 10 minutes?
And it's like, I knew I had the time. It was just this. Just like,
when do I start?
Resistance.
Starting is the problem.
Yeah.
So for me, I have that problem. I'll have all the time in the world to do something, but I'll sit there for an hour contemplating on actually doing it. And I'm like, I just burned an hour thinking about it and I could have done it already. You know what I mean? So ritual does teach you how to start things at a certain time too and stay on that schedule. And so I guess that could be a way that ritual is really important for us, because if you have a certain schedule and timely manner about you, then you'll always stay true to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then that's one benefit of being part of a group that does a similar ritual is that you might not do it as much, but you won't go too far astray. You'll remember, right? Like, because you'll go to the group and then the group will remind you about the ritual and you'll see the benefits, or maybe one of your brothers will say what's going on that will inspire you.
Someone to call you and be like, hey, you're getting out of balance here. What's going on? You okay?
Yeah.
You know, do we need to talk to you? Do you know you need some help? You know, but other than that, yeah, like you say, being a part of some groups, they keep you kind of in balance just because of the energy alone. It's just like, I don't want to get out of character, because no one is. You know, I'll be the only one. That sometimes the intimidation of that keeps people in line too.
I have noticed too that there can be a long friendships that are not always, but they can develop through joining groups that have these rituals, and they'll have lifetime friends. And because one of the things we forget about friendship is that friendship is built through common experiences. And you have to in Masonry, it isn't all online. You have to literally get together.
Yeah, because, and like you said, you build friendships, because We've had people that just joined, and then they had to call me and get my help on, you know, reading certain things. And I'm like, I was able to lend a hand to someone I completely didn't even know a month or two ago, or 3 months ago, rather. You know what I mean? So, like you say, it's intriguing to be a part of groups like that.
So it seems to me, when you look at, like, if you break down the idea of ritual, it seems like a good ritual would be something you could do both in a group and on your own at times. Like, it'd have both avenues at the same time.
You could do a lot of things alone that you do with other folks, I guess, like you say. Yeah, it depends on what it is, but most things you could pretty much accomplish alone. Some people need, you know, another person or a group, but some people could do things alone. Like, I like to think I could do things alone, but then I probably just won't even do it. So I might need a group, you know what I mean? Because if not, I'll do it on my time, and then my time won't work for everyone else.
There's another interesting aspect to ritual, too, which is, again, the idea of the devotion, the dedication that you put into it. And there's something about that, too, you know, that it's more than just a passing influence in just a moment, but it's something that you're really putting all of that time and all of that effort into on a consistent basis. And I know with learning the Masonic ritual, we have 3 degrees and when you become a Freemason. And as Chris has mentioned, in our jurisdiction, they all have to be memorized. And to be master of the lodge, as I was, you have to memorize all of it. And if I had to recite it from beginning to end, it would take probably 3.5 hours to do. And you have to memorize it word for word for word. So there's a certain focus that you're bringing to your mind. And I think that there really is a benefit to that with some of the more elaborate rituals, especially with the memorization types of rituals, that there's something about that focus that is very powerful.
Yeah, I know that a lot of the Tibetan Buddhist teachers have to memorize amazing amounts of material. And even if you were not to be interested in Buddhism, you can really respect the training they have. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why initially when I was, you know, more involved in sort of the meeting New Age people that were supposedly teachers, spiritual teachers, it was really hard for me to kind of equate it to the teachers I had met that had these rigorous, mm-hmm. and I mean, they're Christian priests that go through this too, the seminary. They have these rigorous trainings. And I still have mixed feelings about, you know, comparing them to be equivalent. Mm. In that, even if, let's say, the priest doesn't turn out to be a good person,
right,
the teachings alone and the dedication it takes, I think we've lost a little respect wrongly for this kind of training in spirituality, whether you want to be a Muslim or a Christian or a Buddhist. And I really respect anyone that I think is dedicated to something that is trying to help people, you know. So I think that all that memorization, teaching you focus. I mean, you can see that a ritual can be something quite simple to something quite complex, and yet to me they're all really valuable. Mm-hmm. And maybe some of us, all of us people that like ritual, would have a mix of them in our lives. You know, little ones and big ones,
right?
And, you know,
small ones we do in the morning, little ones, then bigger ones we do at night. Yeah.
Now, one of the things I've noticed that's important for me with ritual is not to kind of go on cruise control. So if you've done a ritual many, 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 many times, this is true for doing readings, like tarot readings. I could probably just go on to kind of cruise control instead of just being very present and trying to stay awake in the moment in something that's very familiar, like when you've done a ritual so many times.
Right, and then you catch yourself drifting off, losing focus every time you try to do it, because it's like, oh man, I've done this the last 10 years. I need a break. And then when you get that break, you're like, man, I didn't need to take that break, because it kind of threw my whole scheduling off. I'm used to doing a certain thing. I'm used to being a certain way. And then when I don't do it, now I'm not at peace like I usually be. I don't know. I've never really done like a ritual or like a little, what can I say, meditation-like thing. So maybe I need to start.
There's something interesting about that too, though, in the sense that perhaps you lose the focus a little bit, and it becomes a little bit more automatic on some level. And so a part of you thinks that perhaps this is no longer working or it's not as powerful. But then, you know, once you stop doing the ritual, you realize that it really was. You know, mm-hmm. you've just gotten so used to it.
And
it's kind of like with us doing tarot readings. You know, we've done... In between Chris and I, we think somewhere around 40,000 to 50,000 readings for people. But again, you know, so we can kind of get in and out of it really fast. But at the same time, even though it seems like it's less effort than it was when we first started, is it not just as powerful? It's just that we kind of relate to it in a slightly different way.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because sometimes you're right. It's just that you're so fluent in it that you think it's not working. And then the other thing that helps me with rekindling that energy of ritual is if someone new comes along, mm. like someone that's never heard about Kabbalah, mm-hmm. and they get so excited, or they, you know, there's that whole beginner's mind. They say something that really is, wow, I hadn't thought of it that way, mm-hmm. you know. So that kind of reignites, you know, interest in whatever the ritual I'm involved with too. So that's one, again, it's a nice thing about, yes, you can do rituals alone, but I would argue technically you're not doing any ritual alone, because A, unless you just completely made it up yourself and you had no spiritual deities or anything in it, so you're not calling on forces, then maybe you could do something alone. But I don't think most people do that. Most people that do sort of solitude or solitary rituals, they'll have a deity, they'll have an energy. They often will initially get inspired through someone, a book they read, and then they maybe make up their own ritual. So you're really being influenced by the writer and these invisible beings, I would say.
Makes sense, yeah. Because if you, like you say, if you didn't create it, then you're not alone with it. Someone else is actually doing it and have done it, and their spirit is probably doing it with you as you do it if they're not here anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and even maybe your ancestors interested in you.
Yeah, right.
They're like,
because
looking
I've been
over
having
your...
some dreams, and I'm like, oh, goodness, who are you?
But, you know, I mean, in a way, it's a broad topic, but in my mind, when I think of ritual, I don't personally, I think you can make things into ritual, but I would argue, is it effective ritual? In other words, you know, when you go back to like the tea ceremony, the reason I think it's effective, it's there's a lot of thought that's been put into the tea, and there's a lot of thought being put into how you present the tea and what kind of tea. So it isn't, you know, what my little ritual of just having a ginger tea and apple is really not the same. You know, in a way it's ritualistic, I guess, but I would say it's probably not something that would change my consciousness the way a tea ceremony might if I got involved in doing the tea ceremony. So maybe there's levels of rituals, and not that one is better than the other, but depending on what is my intention in my life, do I want to grow and become a more conscious, which is, I think, a good thing to look at, a more conscious human being, or do I'm okay and I just want to keep, you know, being who I am.
And then I think if you want to stay who you are, just keep it the same way. But if you want to do more, then just add to the ritual, right? Make it 15 minutes instead of 10. Make it 20 minutes instead of 15. Add to it.
Well, that's why organizations, I think, add rituals in. And maybe the boredom factor, but the idea that, okay, you know, maybe this person's only going to stay at this level, and that's fine, but somebody else wants to go further. So let's have these other rituals that this person who wants to go further.
Right.
Maybe that's
how the York and Scottish Rite came about.
Could be. And I know with the Order of Eastern Star, they wanted to include women.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that was the idea of expanding the idea of ritual, even though women were being included in other Masonic rituals in Europe. They have some other ones that came before Eastern Star. But it was very innovative for its time, because men and women could practice together.
Yep. I thought that was really nice to have. So I'm going to go check something like that out one day.
You should. I think that it's nice to sort of see what is going on if you're interested in it within your own, you know, I guess, school of ritual, and find out, you know, maybe there's something there that would be, you know, different. Definitely there's some similarities, because Michael, in terms of maybe ideas, but in the Eastern Star, the lectures of each of the star points are very touching. And even if you just went to, you know, one of those, once you were a member and saw that, and they stuck with me. I really enjoyed it, even though I didn't know a lot about the Old Testament. Most of the Old Testament women, like Ruth and Esther, and their sort of moral plays. But they're quite lovely the way it's done. And like I said, it's not as long as the Blue Lodge, but still it's very meaningful.
Yeah, because ours could be pretty long.
I just know from hearing Michael, you know, memorizing when he did memorize it. He's got a great memory.
A doozy. Yeah. Oh yeah, he does. He's just like a tape recorder.
Yeah, he's got a great memory.
Wish I could borrow his for a minute.
Well, he did practice a lot.
Yeah.
And then he retains it. So one of the things is that, in fact, sometimes some people say if you practice before you go to bed, that's good for memory. You can make that part of your going to sleep ritual.
I was going to say, that could be a part of my going to sleep ritual. After I read, go to sleep.
Yeah.
Nice.
Now, reading can definitely be a ritual, too. People will sometimes have times that they read, certain types of books they read, and it can be sort of ritualistic in that sense, too.
I know I like to read when I'm on a bus or the train.
I do, too.
I just start reading something.
Yeah, I do, too. Some people get carsick. I don't at all. I enjoy it.
Well, when I'm at work, I just start looking over something for a minute. It's only when I have time to kill in one area. Well, time to read. I guess this is when I read. So maybe I just use that time to read when I need to.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to say something, Michael?
No, I was just thinking that we talk about ritual as if it always has to be almost a heavy thing. And I think maybe there are examples of comedic ritual almost, you know, that make us feel lighter. Mm. And I'm wondering if in Buddhism, if there's any focus on humor in some aspect.
I think that my feeling is more maybe not directly, except maybe some of the Zen koans, I think, have some humor in them. You know, that Zen seems to have, like, in its writing, kind of humor built in. The one thing I do remember, this isn't so much humor, but I remember Kenpo Rinpoche said you can approach Buddhism either through fear, like, and you're in pain, or through joy. Like, you could have either is an okay approach. So I remember thinking, like, well, that's interesting. Because, you know, like, some people are drawn into religion because they're in pain, right? And they look at, you know, life is painful. And so you could have also the attitude of just being drawn through the joy of doing. So I would say one of the things is, I wouldn't say so much humor, but there's an element of play and playfulness. The lamas were sometimes really funny. I remember we'd be doing, like, a puja at night, and they would, like, throw toys at each other. And they would sometimes do things spontaneously to kind of break up the ritual. Kenpo Rinpoche was known for doing that and just making people laugh. So I would say that maybe not so much prescribed by it, but it seems like the teachers that had done a lot of practice had natural, spontaneous humor during very serious moments. They'd just do something you weren't expecting.
Right, and then it'd just break everyone out of character for a second.
Right. So in that way, they do have humor. I don't know if they have it within the teachings themselves.
Well, I think that, you know, there is an aspect of ritual that can definitely appeal to the inner child, as you said. There's a playfulness to a lot of ritual. And I think that, you know, that's an important aspect of much of it.
Yeah, and I think that some of that can happen very spontaneously in groups or something, you know, where someone does something funny and everybody just kind of relaxes. And certainly the idea of not taking yourself too seriously, which we've talked about on different shows, is probably important no matter what you're doing in life.
Yeah, I try to tell people all the time that, you know, what you're saying in your head is only that important in your head. When you say it to us, it's not that important. So let's not act like your word is just law. Because we all have the same opinion, you know. So some people just feel like whatever they say just goes, and I'm like, that's so unfair for everyone else on this planet for you to just be like, oh, well, I don't think so. And I'm like, okay,
that's right.
Like, what does that mean?
I think one of the aspects of ritual, though, that is important is that, for me anyway, I think it brings some sense of well-being. And I think that many, many rituals, I think, really have that ultimate effect where it makes you feel some sense of the universe being in order, some sense of an inner peace, and some sense of a well-being that I think it's just achieved through ritual.
That's an excellent point. And also for me, when you said that, to me, doing ritual, I feel more included, whether it's through a group, whether it's my inner world expands to feel more connected to all those people that are doing the ritual. For me, a really good ritual makes me feel a natural sense of inclusion. Like, I don't have to force it.
Right. It's like they said earlier, it's a part of you now. So it's just, you're just doing what you do. You know, yeah. That's how you get about your day. And then tomorrow's going to be the same thing.
Yeah.
Keeps you on a schedule. Good regimen.
Yeah, it's true. It's so important. And it for me, I think having not grown up with any kind of forced ritual,
right,
to have so much ritual in my life, I'm kind of happy my parents didn't do that. And I think if I had kids, I would just introduce them to things.
Same here. Like, my mom didn't force me to go to church growing up, but when I went to Alabama, my granddad did. But he was the Mason, so he's like, "We're going to church, buddy, and you're gonna get up. Let's go." And I'm like, "Well, I guess, you know, this is his ritual. Every Sunday, everyone's going to church.
Yeah,
that's his ritual. Everyone gets out of the house and go to church with him on Sunday, and then." After we get back, now we're back out of his way.
but funny, we talk about ritual and the church in particular, and I'm thinking the Catholic Church. And, you know, when it was done in Latin, And then there was this belief that people were getting turned off because they didn't speak enough Latin, and so they tried to switch it up to English. But to me, even not being able to speak the language, there's something impressive about the ritual itself that creates an incredible energy and vibe. And I think in some ways it lost something when they went away from the Latin. But for me, again, as I said, not even being able to understand the words, it doesn't mean that I'm not impacted by the ritual itself.
Right.
That's very true. My mom said that she was raised Catholic and she wasn't even going to church, but she said it lost a lot when they stopped doing the Mass in Latin.
Like, yeah, I mean, like you said, not being able to understand the words, but you can still feel the rhythm. I listen to an artist, Bad Bunny, Spanish artist. I can't understand anything he's saying, but it just feels good when I listen to it, you know? Huh. So it's just, I listen to it.
Huh.
I saw his concert and I was like, oh, this is good.
Huh. That's a funny name, Bad Bunny. I love it.
Yeah. he's hilarious. It's so funny. But I saw him when, because I watch wrestling. So he went and did that. And I was like, oh, okay, nice. Good to see you. And then when I started listening to him, I was like, I don't know what you're saying, but it sounds good. You got a lot of fans. So apparently it's good.
Yeah, you don't. It is true. It's. I mean, words are like music that way. Languages. You don't have to necessarily understand it to be moved by it or touched by it. I remember I heard, I think it was when I was in Israel, I went to Israel for a summer when I was young, and I went, I think it was a Mass done in French, and I didn't know much French, and it was just so beautiful, and I was so moved by it. I remember, like, it was an amazing, I still even can see it in my mind. It was a beautiful, like, morning, and I remember the light coming through the stained glass windows, and it was just kind of frozen there as a memory. And so maybe it's also the people doing the rituals feeling their connection to the ritual. If you're really connected and you do a ritual for people, we feel it.
Just like a great artist. Right. I was going to say it makes it come to life for us, so now we actually feel it without even having to do it ourselves. It's like, oh, wow, I actually feel him standing. He won't even be right next to me, but it's like I feel them right next to me saying, you know what I mean, or going through it. It's like you say, if the artist is good, you'll feel it better.
So it is true. I think ritual and art have a correlation. And you do see a lot of artists that are drawn to ritualistic groups.
It's like a guitarist. They could play the same tune, but if they're sitting still, you're not going to feel it than if they're, you know, putting all the gyrations in it, jumping around, you know, moving their head. You're not going to feel it if they're just sitting there, you know what I mean? It's just gonna be like, oh, well.
Lifeless.
Yeah, it's just like, okay, well, then I'm just listening to this tune, you know?
So if someone wanted to start, like, a more... to have more ritual in their life, what would you advise based on your experience for them to look for?
Probably not me to tell them because I don't have any type of so they will. I will probably tell them, stay away from me when you need to find out about that. Go to Krista.
No.
Because she knows all the good rituals.
No,
she just taught me how to go to sleep at night, read, and I will be sleeping 10 minutes. I know that for a fact.
Michael used to like to watch Bigfoot because it put him to sleep.
Oh, see?
Even though he likes the Bigfoot.
I was going to say, I like wrestling. I put that on last night and it made me go to sleep. And I was like, oh, good.
Yeah.
I had such a bad headache. It was so bad, I still feel the after effects now. I was like, ugh.
Oh, yeah, I used to say the best part of finding Bigfoot is you could fall asleep 5 minutes in, wake up with 5 minutes left, and know you hadn't missed anything because every episode was exactly the same. Mm-hmm. But it sort of did become my sleep ritual there for a while when I was napping.
Avatar, it's like 3 hours long. Huh. One day I was like, I'm gonna put this movie on because I'm kind of like bored and just want to lay down. I fell asleep and I was like, I fell asleep for a good amount of time. Then I woke up and still had a good amount of time to finish watching that movie. I was like, that is a long movie. That's a long movie when you could take a full nap, wake up and still have another hour and some change left of the movie. I'm like, I watched at least an hour before I went to sleep. And woke up and still had another. I'm like, good Lord, this movie is long.
Huh. That's funny. Well, thank you so much for coming. This was a really fun conversation.
No problem. It was fun to be
get
here.
To know you more. And
taught me a lot about ritual.
Well, I learned from you too, especially the whole thing about patience. That was really great.
It was because, you know, like I say, it's hard to explain sometimes when you play a sport that really has no patience in it, you know, for certain people. And then you got to go out in the real world and display patience. I'm like, for the people that could do that, those are some talented dudes and women. But for the people like me that can only do one thing, we're steadily learning.
Well, thank you again, and thank you all for listening in. Join us next time as we continue to explore the esoteric and the obscure together. And have a great week.
Thank you, Elza.